In a world of pure imagination, take a look and you'll see. Into your imagination, we'll begin with a spin, traveling in a world of my creation. What we'll see will defy explanation. If you want to view paradise, simply look around and view it. Anything you want to, do it. Want to change the world? There's nothing to it.
A little pure imagination from Michael Feinstein to begin this portion of our program. We're going to talk today about imagination, about make-believe, about creative play. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. So glad you could join us today. Our guest is Susan Lin. She says when it comes to children's make-believe, less is more. Think how little is needed to engage a child's imagination. A sock becomes a puppet. A tube from a roll of paper towels becomes a telescope. A blanket and a couple of chairs becomes a tent. The sofa becomes a bus. We're on our way. Susan Lin is concerned that this kind of make-believe, this kind of play, is endangered in our plugged-in 24/7 world, where the preschool entertainment is that where preschool entertainment is a multi-billion-dollar business. Play, says Lin, is essential to the development of creativity, empathy, critical thinking, problem-solving, and making meaning. Susan Lin writes about her concerns and the importance of imaginative play in her new book, The Case for Make-Believe, Saving Play in a Commercialized World. Susan Lin is a psychologist at Judge Baker Children's Center and Harvard Medical School in Boston. In addition, she is co-founder and director of Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood. She's also an award-winning ventriloquist. Her work has been seen on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, The Today Show, and Good Morning America. The Case for Make-Believe is Susan Lin's second book. Her first was Consuming Kids, The Hostile Takeover of Childhood. Both books are published by The New Press. Susan Lin, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Hi, Celeste. I'm really happy to be talking with you.
Oh, I'm glad to be talking with you as well. This was interesting to me. In your book, you say time for play in school, even in kindergarten, has been eroded. Do we see play as not worthy or not as worthy?
I think that we have, as a society, we've taken play for granted. And also that in recent years, we have been treating children more as objects than as developing human beings. And so, you know, the whole notion of with no child left behind, teaching to test, and the idea of, you know, that academics need to be pushed even in preschool is really antithetical to how young children really truly learn. They learn through exploration, and they explore through creative play.
Hmm. And you say we're preventing children from playing. How are we managing to do that?
Really, as a society, we seem to be doing just about everything we can to keep children from playing. You just mentioned the way that, you know, play is being drummed out of kindergarten and recess. We don't have recess as much in school anymore. The classes where children in school used to be able to play art, you know, music, drama, those are being cut. As they're not, people think that they're not really as important as other parts of schooling, when they're making budget cuts, those are the ones that are eliminated. But what concerns me even more is that for the first time in history, we can't assume that when children have leisure time, that they're engaged in creative play. And that's because of the combination of sophisticated, ubiquitous screen media and unfettered commercialism. I mean, that's just a disaster for children's creative play.
Mm. Also, is there a role here that's being played by all the scheduling that goes on for some kids?
For children of a particular class,
yeah.
Scheduling is a problem. I mean, so kids are not playing pick-up sports games where they can make up their own rules. They're doing more organized sports or taking, you know, all sorts of classes at a very early age. So, you know, that's true that the time for creative play has diminished. But I that is a problem. But I think what's more concerning is, as I said, even when children have leisure time, we can't count on the fact that they'll be playing creatively. Mm-hmm. They're more likely to be in front of a screen. And the things that children do with screens, even, you know, computer games or video games, are not particularly creative endeavors.
Yeah. Well, tell us about the little boy who had read Harry Potter but had not seen the films. He drew his own idea of Mad Eye Moody, and he was told, "You got it wrong."
Yeah, I mean, this mom was telling me that her son came home from school really upset because he drew a picture of Mad Eye Moody, who is this great character in Harry Potter who has this magical eye, and you can imagine what you could do with that. And this little girl told him that he was wrong. She didn't even say, "That's not how I see it." She said, "You're wrong." And that's because she had seen the movie and he hadn't. And I think that what we see on the screen carries so much weight that it does become, you know, what the model is or what's right.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, one thing that parents could do, one very simple thing that parents could do to help with their children's creative play is to have children read the book before they see the movie. Hmm. Give them an opportunity to create their own vision of the characters before their vision of the characters becomes, you know, Hollywood's vision. Mm.
You say you're neither a technophobe nor a Luddite. So can we feel okay about some television time, some computer time, some toys developed by Disney or Mattel? You know, can we feel okay about a little Elmo, a little SpongeBob?
I think that the problem is that it's not a little. It's permeating children's lives. And I really struggle with this a lot. I worked in television. I worked with Fred Rogers and, you know, performed with my puppets on, you know, on television programs. And I grew up with television, and television played an important role in my fantasy life. I mean, I became a ventriloquist because of, you know, ventriloquists I saw on television. I didn't grow up in a family of ventriloquists. Mm. And there were, you know, media characters like Walt Disney's Peter Pan that really I played about for hours and hours and hours. And as I was writing the case for Make Believe, I really struggled about, well, how can I be critical of what's happening today? But there's really a huge difference. And the difference is it's a matter of scale and access. So I saw Disney's Peter Pan once when I was six, and I didn't see it again until I was 19. So if I wanted to evoke the feelings that Peter Pan, that I felt when I was seeing the movie, I had to play about it. I didn't have any choice. Mm. I had to play about it. Mm. But today, kids own movies, or they rent them, and they see them over and over and over and over again. Or they see television programs, you know, over and over and over again. And so what happens is that the scripts become embedded in their minds, and that really puts a damper on their creative play. Mm. And then the other problem is that most of the toys, the best-selling toys today, really inhibit rather than promote creative play. Either they're tied to media programs, and kids play less creatively with those, or they're embedded with computer chips. So all a child has to do is press a button, and toys are talking and giggling and doing backflips and having a lot more fun, actually, than the child.
Mm. Susan Lin is our guest this afternoon on the program. She is the author, most recently, of The Case for Make-Believe, Saving Play in a Commercialized World. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800 1-800-222-9455. We've got a couple of listeners who would like to join us this afternoon. So let's go and take our first call this afternoon. A listener in Hoopston, line 4. Hi.
Hi, Celeste. Another great program. Thank you so much. Just had a couple of quick story and observation, and then I'll let your guest comment. My wife teaches ballet, tap dance, what have you, and the kids, I have a 12-year-old and a 7-year-old, and they just had a great time this summer. They put on two plays, Music Man for Juniors and Cinderella, and they were out of the house constantly preparing, auditioning, and then finally got to appear in front of a live audience. And I was just thinking, what a great way to spend the summer. And, okay, great way to spend the summer, very creative, you know, so on and so forth. But what I observed, I guess, with the kids that have been watching so much TV, I've noticed a lack of ability to communicate and almost a trend towards violence or frustration, I guess, maybe is a better word. And then finally, with the end of creativity, my daughter in first grade had an art teacher, and she made the kids all draw whatever the picture was, a tree or car, but all the pictures had to be exactly the same. And she was very upset with the children if all the pictures did not look exactly alike. And I was like, well, that's kind of stifling creativity, if that's my take on it. I just thought that was a very odd thing for a teacher to be conveying. But anyway, I wanted to share that with your listeners. Great show. I'll hang up and listen off air. Thanks.
Thanks for the call. Susan, you want to make a comment?
Well, I'm certainly concerned about that teacher.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the important thing about creativity, it's a way that we get to express who we really are, and we get to see things our way, and that's so important for children. It's important to help them understand the ways that they're both similar and different, you know, from other people. And that is one of the problems with, with the way that we're treating children today, that there's a way in which we don't think that children can create on their own. We think that they have to be now told how to do it. And that's a problem. Our expectations, if we have expectation that every car has to look alike, I mean, that's really troubling for kids.
Yeah. Let's take another call now. A listener in Urbana, line 1. Hi.
Hi, Iman.
Yes.
Oh, thank you. First of all, Celeste, thank you so much for having this guest. I'm very, very happy to hear about all this. And, two, for you, the book, I'm dying to read this now. I'm an elementary education student. I'm seeking my certification right now. I already have a degree in fine arts, and the last year I've been working as an art teacher at a local private preschool. But I heard the caller just before me. I mean, just my heart was sinking. It's like, oh, my gosh, I can't believe there really are people out there like that, but there are. And I'm a huge fan of trying to build things like emotional language in children, developing process for kids, giving them essentially saying, okay, here's the topic for the day. I define the topic along the idea that, you know, here's one side of the road and here's the other side of the road. Now, where does this road go? You know, show me. And what I've noticed in children is so many of them, the age bracket that I was teaching was between 2 and 5. I was teaching them art. And that they all want me to do it. It's like, you do it. You show me. Or, you know, please will you help me? And my response has always been, well, I want to see what you have to say, you know, and the idea that children are getting to express. And some of them catch on very quickly. Some of them don't. Some of them catch on in certain ways. I've always tried to play with the approach. Now, the question that I have for you is, it sounds like that you've really done a lot of work in trying to identify trends in children and how they learn, kind of overlapping a lot of media concerns and justifying that. My question to you is, I'm going to be coming up, I've already likely accepted that I'm going to be working in private preschools in spite of the fact that I have a very egalitarian outlook on things, and I'm going to try and work on my teaching style in private settings where I can kind of do what I want before I try to move into a public realm. But my question is, how does a teacher justify their curriculum in this style with the strictures that we have today, like No Child Left Behind, where there are demands on the teacher to perform or else. And I know within myself very, very deeply, in my own experiences and my own observations, that creative play has incredible value. In application, children learn how to articulate ideas. I have this idea in my mind that maybe one day a child would have a problem and they'd be able to go out and pick up a paintbrush and get it out instead of being angry, or that they would have an idea and be able to articulate it, or have a thought and be able to bring it to fruition. I mean, there's so many hopes that I have when I plant these little seeds in kids, but it's difficult to know what I'm doing can be justified, because I don't know of research other than just experience and anecdotal kinds of things, like Alexander Neal and his school in England, Summerhill, or different kinds of teaching models like Montessori or Waldorf. But I'm really interested in how you feel you can find ways to justify these types of endeavors in children. And thank you very much. I'm very glad that you're on the show.
Okay, thanks for the call. Talking to the system, how do you do it?
Well, you know, first of all, I'm delighted that your caller is going to be in the classroom. He sounds like he's just going to be a great teacher. And I think what we have to do is actually we're re-educating parents today about the importance of play. It didn't used to be an issue, but it is now. I was in a preschool that had signs all over. I'd never seen this before, but over the water table, you know, it was, when your child plays with water, your child is learning, you know, about gravity or liquids, or, you know, all over the play stations in the room, there were, you know, sort of points or things that the children were learning. But, you know, in fact, there's you know, a lot of research, you know, showing that creative play is, you know, incredibly educational for children, and that it's how they learn how to learn. You know, it's the key to school success. And I do talk about these things in my book. So I think that the message that you know, we have to give parents and administrators who are working with young children, is really there's nothing more important for children to be doing than to be playing creatively. Mm. I mean, you know, especially in preschool, it's just the foundation of you know, most of what's worthwhile about being human.
Yeah, maybe we should back up here and talk a little bit about what is creative play. What does it look like? And you know, a couple of other basic questions. Why is it so important? We've touched on it, but we really haven't, you know, delved really into it. And the other big question is, why do children play? Why do they need to play?
Well, let's start with the last one and sort of work backwards. I mean, children use make-believe play to conquer their fears, to explore their hopes and dreams. And babies are born with the innate capacity to play. It develops naturally in just a good enough environment. The problem is that immersion in commercialized culture actually prevents them from doing what they would be doing, you know, naturally. So if we want to raise healthy, creative, curious, thinking children, we need to just ensure them plenty of experience with being able to conjure something out of nothing, or transforming, or making use of external objects to fulfill their internal dreams.
Hmm.
Creative play is it involves some kind of transformation and bringing something of ourselves to what we're doing. So, you know, it could be, you know, you start out with blocks and you build something with the blocks, or, you know, you transform yourself from, you know, a little girl to a mom, or from a little boy to a dad, or, you know, a little girl to a dad, or whatever. But, you know, it involves transformation where you know, children, you know, have an opportunity to experiment and where there's not just one way of doing things, but lots of different ways, and you get to try out all different kinds of plays.
Hmm.
of ways of playing or ways of being in the world.
Mm. I know that here at WILL, we have a community outreach effort, and it includes children in literacy. And one of the things that they do with younger kids is they have a wonderful box of this and that and everything. And then they take it out, and then the kids build their or make their own costumes. And it's pretty amazing to see how excited they get and where they take that.
That's wonderful. And you know, what it does, among other things, is to develop sort of a love of story and storyline and to be able to actually, the kids can really just get in the middle of it. I mean, encouraging kids to act out, you know, or to play, engage in dramatic play, I think really is connected with literacy. Mm.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Susan Lin. She's a child psychologist. She is the author most recently of The Case for Make-Believe, Saving Play in a Commercialized World. She's a psychologist at Judge Baker Children's Center and Harvard Medical School in Boston. In addition, she's co-founder and director of Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood. You'll find her on the web at www.consumingkids.com. She also happens to be an award-winning ventriloquist, and she uses that skill in her work. Her work has been seen on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, The Today Show, and Good Morning America. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. How did your work with puppets begin?
Well, actually, like most ventriloquists, I began as a child. I got interested in it when I was about six, and my parents got a book out of the library about ventriloquism, and somebody just happened to give me a sock puppet, and I just started talking with the puppet and making the puppet talk, and it was just so incredible to have this little creature that could say things that I might be afraid to say directly. So it was really fun, and I started doing performances and started performing on, you know, local television shows when I was a kid, and eventually actually had a year of lessons from a professional ventriloquist. I grew up in Detroit, named Jerry Whitman, and the kind of it just took off from there.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit now about Audrey Duck.
Oh, yeah. Well, would you like to speak to Audrey Duck?
Oh, how lovely. I'd love to speak with Audrey.
Audrey, would you like to speak to Celeste?
Hello, Celeste.
Hi,
I'm
Audrey.
Audrey Duck.
Hi, Audrey.
Hi, I'm a puppet.
Hi.
I like your show. I like your voice.
Oh, thank you. I like your voice, too.
Thank you. It's very soothing, your voice.
Oh, thank you.
I appreciate it. Yeah. Can I keep talking, Susan?
No, I think you better go, Audrey.
I don't want to.
I know, but you have to.
I don't want to. Audrey, bye-bye.
Bye. Maybe we'll talk to Audrey before the hour's out. Now, what you did there was interesting, and it's something you talk about in the book, and that is setting limits, establishing boundaries. You know, you said, no, you got to go, Audrey.
Right. And also, the play is filled with paradox, and one part of the paradox is that in order to have the freedom to play, there have to be limits and boundaries for kids. They have to be safe. They have to be physically safe, and they also have to be emotionally safe. And so, you know, one of the ways to do that is you know, to help them just check in to make sure about, you know, the difference. That they know the difference between reality and fantasy. They can pretend that their monster is attacking somebody, but they can't really hurt anybody. Mm-hmm. And if two children are playing together and one of them is frightened, that child won't be able to play. So, you know, one of the things that's important to do in order to give the children freedom to express is to make sure that they're safe, and you do that by setting boundaries and limits.
Yeah. In play, a lot of strong emotion, a lot of powerful feelings can come out. How do you work with that?
Well, you know, for one thing, creative play is inherently therapeutic. And it's therapeutic all by itself. You know, if you watch, you know, children playing creatively, they're often playing about, you know, their hopes and their dreams and their fears. And they do play about strong emotions. And, you know, as long as everybody's safe, I mean, I think that that's really important to let them do that. And you know, just to sort of recognize that it may be a way for them to be working out things that they're struggling with or that they're having problems with. Because, you know, children do naturally express feelings in play, it's also such a wonderful tool for play therapy.
Mm. One of the children that you write about in the book, in the second part of the book, is a five-year-old named Michael, who's very anxious about leaving his preschool and heading off to the big world of kindergarten. And you worked with him on that. Talk with us a little bit about what he was feeling and how it came out, and then how you help him.
Yes, he was such a great little boy, and he just came in one day and was really, really, really angry and was throwing cushions around. It was so, you know, unlike him that I knew that something was really troubling with him. And in his play with my puppet, sort of the whole issue of leaving came up. And I began to realize that he was worried about leaving daycare and going to kindergarten. He'd been in this daycare for all of his life and was very safe there and was very well loved there, and he was leaving and he was really upset about that. And so what I did is have my puppet Audrey Duck express her own feelings about leaving and talk about her, you know, feeling sad or mad about having to leave. And that way I wasn't, you know, putting it on him. He could accept that or reject it. He could play about it or not play about it. I just sort of threw it out. But he picked up on it, you know, right away. And it was clear to me, you know, from that this was an issue that was really troubling him. And what he ended up doing with Audrey Duck is creating a whole blues song about leaving. Yeah. I mean, he was so great. I mean, he'd clearly seen people singing the blues, and we created together the Leaving Daycare Blues. It was just so wonderful.
Yeah.
So I got the blues. He was singing. It's great.
Yeah. A large part of this is really listening.
Yes, it's listening and listening, you know, hard for themes that are coming up, and then, you know, sort of trying them out. You know, to see if, you know, to see if the kids pick up on them. But, you know, it's really, you know, important to stress, and I do also stress this in the book, that there's certainly a difference between being a therapist and being a parent or even, you know, being a teacher, and that creative play in and of itself is therapeutic.
Yeah. Well, a photo of you and your granddaughters playing together came with the book, and here you're playing and you're not a therapist, you're grandma. Isabella is dancing. Marley is playing a recorder.
Yeah.
How important is it for adults to take part in children's play?
Oh, it's first of all, it's so wonderful. I mean, it's really freeing and delightful. And it's really lucky to be a grandparent. You have, you know, a great chance to be able to play with kids. Sometimes I think it's even easier than playing with your own kids, because you're not, you know, responsible for having to get them dressed so much and, you know, that kind of thing. So I think, you know, adults, you know, should take every opportunity they can to join kids in playing and to be silly and to be creative. So Marley and Isabella both really love music a lot. And one of the things that they've done in their family is sort of a family band. You know, just people singing and playing silly instruments, and you know, there's so much going on there, including, you know, this sort of deep love of music, and that's, you know, without, you know, having to give them lessons or anything like that. It's just fostering this incredible love of music and of making music.
Mm. I remember when I was a kid, my brothers and I would go to one of our grandmother's house, and she had a piano, and we thought we were making beautiful music. The adults were, after a while, said, no, that's enough. But but we were having a marvelous time.
Right.
We were pretending we were, you know, we were Leonard Bernstein, and, you know, we were conducting an orchestra, and all we had was this piano and one another.
And you don't need much.
Yeah.
For creative play. I mean, the best play is really when we bring ourselves to it and we don't depend on outside stimulation.
Hmm. You play with your grandchildren and play is part of your work. Is imagination also important for the well-being of adults?
Absolutely. I mean, it's really play, creativity, and health, mental health, I mean, they're all, you know, part and parcel of the same thing. It's essential for us to play, and it's really, I think, where we have our most satisfying moments. And when you're working, it's the product that's most important. But when you're playing, it's the process. And I find, you know, when I'm writing or you know, working with Audrey or, you know, something like that, that the times that I'm most creative are when I can just kind of let myself know, go, and not worry about a deadline, but lose myself in the process of what I'm doing. And that's, ironically enough, I mean, that's when I accomplish the most.
Hmm.
It's another paradox of play, actually.
Hmm. Yeah. Reasons for playing with children, one of them, and this was the way, one of the ways you, I think, if I'm recalling correctly, you realized that puppets could be more than just a way for you to make a living. Your friend Zoe told you that, you know, puppets are very helpful when it comes to smoothing out unnecessary conflict. tell us about that. Part of the, you know,
yeah,
that bonus.
That was so funny because that happened when my daughter was reaching that, you know, stage of toddlerhood where she was very independent and asserting her independence. And like every other parent, I found myself getting into power struggles with her. And I was relating this to a good friend, and she got this strange tone in her voice. We were talking on the phone. She got this strange tone in her voice, and she said, Susan, I find puppets are really useful. And I said, oh, puppets, what a great idea. And she said, Susan, I learned that from you. I was so immersed in, you know, trying to be a good parent that I just forgot about playing. And so, you know, you can get over hurdles with kids. I mean, like, you know, sometimes you get into struggles, especially with two-year-olds or two-and-a-half-year-olds around getting dressed. So I started making my daughter's socks argue with each other about which one could go on first,
mm-hmm.
you know, so she got to choose, or I'd have her peas calling her to come and eat dinner.
Yeah.
You know, Sasha, your peas are calling you. So, it's a way of really sort of averting conflict and getting, you know, children to sometimes to buy into the things that they don't really, you know, want to do. I mean, we used to make silly noises, you know, when she would brush her teeth. You know, you know, that mm-hmm. kind of thing.
Yeah.
Well, I think anything that you can do to make, you know, sort of those tasks of daily living fun
yeah.
is really helpful, especially when, you know, kids are going through periods where they're really wanting to assert their independence, and you keep getting into power struggles with them.
Yeah. Well, you know, the bathtub is kind of one of those fighting territories, and one great way to get in there is, you know, blowing bubbles or toy ducks or rubber ducks boats and that kind of thing, and then, you know, you can't get them out.
Right.
They're all wrinkly.
Right, and then you have to have the towels call to them or something.
Yes.
Yeah, no, baths are, I mean, to, you know, to be immersed in water. I mean, kids just love water if they're not thinking of it,
as the washcloth and the bar of soap and
right.
the
so,
shampoo.
You know, we used to play, ooh, where's the soap? when my daughter was in the bathtub. And actually, I used to play it with my sister in the bathtub when we were kids, where we'd have a bar of soap, and both of us would try to reach for it. It was all slippery and everything. And then whoever got the soap had to wash some part of their body or something.
Mm, yeah. Susan Lynn is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine, the author most recently of The Case for Make-Believe, Saving Play in a Commercialized World. She is also the author of Consuming Kids, The Hostile Takeover of Childhood. Both books are published by the New Press. Listeners, we have about 10 minutes left in this portion of the program. If you'd like to join us with a question, a comment, a story of your own, we'd love to hear from you. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. One of the things that you say about play, and we've talked a little bit about it here, play is healing. And you were doing some work with a Head Start program when you began to realize and reflect on how important play is in healing. And you realized that here you had these little children who would really open up and talk to Audrey Duck. Where did you go from there?
Ultimately back to school.
Yeah.
it became clear to me. I was in a Head Start program, and the justification for me being there with my puppets was language development. And what I found is that, you know, the kids were talking about really important things with the puppets, both using puppets themselves and also just chatting with Audrey about sibling rivalry or going to the dentist, you know, or things that were going on in their lives. And that's when I realized that I began to realize the potential of using puppets and using, you know, play therapy as a way of healing. And so I got a job at Boston Children's Hospital doing play therapy with puppets with kids, you know, coping with all sorts of illnesses, from kids with cancer to kids having been hit by a car or cystic fibrosis, this whole range of medical problems. And you know, what I found in over that 7 years is the kids, you know, look forward so much to being able to engage in puppet play, and that they use the puppets to say things that they could not say directly. I mean, this one little girl, you know, told my puppet that she was going to be cut up in a million pieces and served to the doctors. And that was a little girl who had just myriad surgeries. She'd been hospitalized for a year and had surgery after surgery after surgery. Mm. And she couldn't say that, this is what I feel like. But that's the metaphor that she created.
Yeah. There was also a little boy by the name of Joey who you worked with. And his sister Laura was so ill, and she died. And he had a number of ways of talking with you that were rather cryptic. How do you listen? How do you learn what a kid is really trying to tell you or what's really on their mind?
Uh-huh.
Their minds?
I think, first of all, therapists are trained.
Right.
And one of the things that you know, we are trained to do is to be able to separate our own issues from the issues of the people that we're working with. I mean, that's important for any therapist, whether working with adults or children. So that's, you know, just very, very, very important. And then, you know, if you listen to children and listen to what they're playing and think about the themes that are coming out, it really is just so often metaphors, you know, for the, you know, the things that they've gone through. I mean, one of the things that I write about is with Joey, is that he started giving this right at the day that his sister died, and she died after he had been a donor in a bone marrow transplant. So he had undergone all of these procedures and painful and, you know, shots and everything. And so he started giving my puppets shots. And I was trying to say, you know, well, there's a reason for the shots, and trying to get him to talk about what the reasons were. And he just, he kept saying, he just said, finally, he said, for no reason. He said, 100 shots for no reason, 1,000,000 shots for no reason. And I realized that, of course, there was no reason. He had undergone all of that, and his sister died anyway.
Yeah.
It was so beautiful.
Yeah. Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign now, line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
One thing you haven't talked about yet is let me ask it as a question. Are human beings the only animal where the kids will play by themselves? You know, you look at cats and dogs, for example, when they're puppies and kittens, they'll play with each other. Now, human beings play with each other also, but is there any indication that other animals will play by themselves like human beings can?
Sure. If you watch dogs, a dog will play with a ball by itself.
Oh, okay.
Or, you know, or cat will play with something by themselves. I think what's different about human play, all animals play. What's different about human, all mammals play anyway. I guess I don't know about fish, but all mammals play. But what's different about a human play, I believe, is our capacity, you know, to transform and to do symbolic play.
And do some what?
That's kind of what's different about it.
Do some what? What kind of play?
Transformation.
Symbolic.
Oh, symbolic.
Symbolic, yeah. I mean, you know,
okay,
so,
sure.
You know, a stick becomes a sword or becomes the mast of a boat or a magic wand, you know, all within 5 minutes or something like that. And I don't see other animals doing that kind of play.
So thank you.
Thanks for the call. Next, we take a call from a listener on campus, line two. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I'm just enjoying this little interview going on. I do have this tremendous experience of playing with my own kids as well as my grandchildren now. This make-believe thing is so sweet. They really don't need anything. Just boxes will be fine. Just maybe just little animals, and you act out as you are the animals yourself. That's what we did this weekend. It was so funny.
Great.
And, like, you know, 4 hours this grandma is playing with this. I tell you, that was exercise. That's in heaven. But it was, I think, the hurt was pleasant and healthy, I must say, you know. And I think when my little daughter was, she used to play a lot of mom, you know, mom kind of story stuff and all this. So under the umbrella, we would make our house, and we'll sit there, and then we'll have that little tea party and stuff like that. Just, it was so cute. And by the way, for this other caller, their dog, this little Rosie, she really plays by herself with a little ball and rocks, and she looks at us and says, "Join me." So, you know, imaginative plays are really, I think, very healthy things, and you can actually read the minds of the children too in that. And I found that when you, as adults, kind of veer away from that a little bit, they say, "IG, that is not. That's make-believe. Come on." You know, I use the grandma in our language. But, you know, those kinds of sweet things. So I'm enjoying it, and I wanted to know the name of your book.
Okay. It is The Case for Make-Believe, and the author is Susan Lynn, L-I-N-N. We have to wrap up now. Susan, do you want to say anything in way of closing us out?
Yes, I think it's really important to remember that when it comes to creative play, less is more, that all of this technology and the screen time really tends to inhibit rather than promote creative play, and which for young children is really more important than just about anything else.
Mm. There we have to leave it. Susan Lynn, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Susan Lynn is the author most recently of The Case for Make-Believe, Saving Play in a Commercialized World, the publisher, The New Press. You'll find her online at www.consumingkids.com.